The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So tonight's talk is about non-harming. Paul Sakharov and I, we did a workshop in November. It's kind of, you know, approaches practice in daily life, and we thought maybe we'll do something on non-harming. So I thought I'd offer some of those thoughts today, and especially that kind of comes as an answer to the question, like, how to skillfully live and act in a time where there's a lot of divisiveness, a lot of anger in the air, a lot of stress. And so how to live skillfully and how to live in a way that is wholesome and non-harming. This aspect of the Buddhist teachings, non-harming, is central. And when you think of the Eightfold Path, the path toward liberation, sila, or morality, is one component of that path, and non-harming falls under that category. So the path, I'll just give a little context to non-harming. The Eightfold Path has three components. You can think of them as like legs to a stool. So three forms of practice, basically. One is concentration, which is what we do when we sit, right? We build stability in the mind. So that's one leg of the stool, concentration. The other is panya, or wisdom. That's insight that often comes with concentration. We see more deeply. And then the third is sila, or morality. And so these are all considered crucial in terms of the path toward liberation, in terms of supporting our freedom, and clarity and insight. So I think a little bit in the 70s and 80s when insight meditation was first evolving in the United States, this piece about morality was interestingly left out or not emphasized, you know, and I think maybe we get a certain taste when we hear the word morality, right? It sort of feels a little bloodless and burdened, or, you know, there's just some associations that we have with that word. But I think that the way that the Buddha talks about sila or morality is quite beautiful and quite enlivening and should not feel like a burden. It should feel aspirational and beautiful. So I just want to talk about that a little bit tonight. This kind of sila is a morality that we discern internally. So it's not about adhering to any kind of laws, whether they are government laws or divine laws, that this is an innate capacity of the heart to understand what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. When we have intentions that will lead to harm and when we have intentions that will lead to goodness. So this is considered an innate quality of the heart, which I consider really encouraging. And the more stable and clear the mind is, the more clear that discerning part of the heart is. So this is part of what we do on the cushion. We come to know our anger. We come to know our fear. We come to know our greed. It's a real investigation. And we learn what stabilizes the mind toward an equanimous mind, which is powerful. And this discernment of what's wholesome and unwholesome comes to life in a bright way. And so I mentioned intentions, like understanding the motivations behind our actions. And they're often complex, right? They're not one thing. They have threads of many intentions. But the Buddha saw this as especially important, cultivating an understanding of intention, an awareness of intention, which is behind every word, every action that we engage in. So this is the Buddha's words. The thought manifests as the word. The word manifests as the deed. The deed develops into habit, and habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let it spring from love, born out of concern for all beings. And this was also, I interpret, a Christian proverb which says this in a slightly different way, which is, what you gaze upon, you will become. So non-harmful speech and conduct begin with our thoughts and our intentions. They are the forerunner to all things. So the Buddha said we need to be heedful of what goes on in our mind, right? It's not just our actions, it's not just our speech. We need to be attentive to our thinking. The Buddha said, every person who is born with an axe in his mouth. So we have the capacity to hurt with our words, the capacity to cause harm with our words. So I'll just say some of the Buddha's words on non-harming. And one is the first precept. Five precepts. They're basically trainings. So they're not rules so much as like life trainings. And the first one is non-harming. And he writes, I undertake the training rule to abstain from taking life and to refrain from harming living things. Okay? So this isn't a dogma. I mean, obviously, we can't move through life without harming living things, right? There's no absolute about this. But we can develop sensitivity and discernment and really take care when we harm living things and understand when we harm living things that we're not unconscious about it. So this is about a deepening skill and a deepening sensitivity as we move through life. And Thich Nhat Hanh, many of you may know, he's from the Mahayana tradition, Vietnamese monk. He put this precept in the positive, and I'd like to read it. And he said, reverence for life. Aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life, I am committed to cultivating the insight of interbeing and compassion and learning ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I am determined not to kill, not to let others kill, and not to support any act of killing in the world, in my thinking, or in my way of life. Seeing that harmful actions arise from anger, fear, greed, and intolerance, which in turn come from dualistic and discriminative thinking, I will cultivate openness, non-discrimination, and non-attachment to views in order to transform violence, fanaticism, and dogmatism in myself and in the world. So I was speaking earlier about this innate quality of the heart to recognize goodness. And the Buddha gets even more specific about it, and he describes these qualities of the heart. He calls hiri otapa. This is a Pali word, and he describes this as the bright guardians of the world. It is associated with skillful actions, and it's divided into two parts. Hiri, which is translated as wholesome regret or wholesome shame, and otapa, which is wholesome fear. Now, words like shame and fear are really charged and loaded, and generally they don't feel wholesome, but this is shame and fear in a really specific way that's just about wholesome action. And it doesn't have any kind of aversion associated with that. So hiri is the wholesome shame. It's an inner conscience, the innate sense of shame that restrains us from doing deeds that would jeopardize our own self-respect. Otapa, the second half of the word, and they always come as a pair, is wholesome fear, a healthy fear of committing unskillful deeds that might bring harm to ourselves or to others. So I first heard these teachings, I think in maybe 2001, from Upandita, and he is sort of a masterful teacher from the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition and kind of a fierce teacher. And it was such a relief to hear about how important, like, and I love the term the bright guardians of the world, like this bright quality of the heart that can be like a guidepost. And what made it so wonderful to hear is like, that squeeze of the heart when we feel we haven't behaved in a wholesome, when we feel we've messed up, right? We set something in motion that either hurt us or hurt somebody else because of our inattention or whatever it might be. And there's that squeeze of the heart that is so hard to feel. Its poignancy is so hard to feel. But this is what we need to receive. We need to let it bloom, and we need to let it inform us. And this doesn't need to be like a lifelong thing. This is like a thing we feel, we learn, and we're enlivened by. This is very different than guilt. Guilt is considered not a skillful mind state. Guilt is when we move from assessing and feeling the consequences of an action to translating that as I'm a bad person. You know, and that can just be a pattern in the mind where that never goes away. Again and again, we just, you know, remember this action and we kind of have that relentless suffering, that tyrannical voice. And this is not that. This is when we feel this bright, the voice of this bright guardian and we learn from it. And then the otapa is actually the aspiration. Now that I've seen that when I do this, this happens, I have that aspiration to be different, to learn from this. Next time, Wynn, don't go down that path, because you know what happens, you know how that feels, you know what that sets in motion. So to really appreciate it as an enlivening practice as opposed to a burden. If it feels burdensome, then that's not practicing correctly with what this means. So I had a retreat at the end of the year, and just, you know, just a simple, clear example of Hiri Otapa came up for me in that retreat. I had a memory of when I was 19, I was a camp counselor at a sort of highfalutin camp in Vermont, where you kind of had to know somebody to get in to be a counselor, and while I was there, the summer long camp, one of the kitchen girls, you know, who's about my age, there was a staff of local young women who worked in the kitchen, who didn't really socialize with the counselors. We were kind of here, and the kitchen staff was here. And I saw she was wearing my earrings that had gone missing. And, you know, she was serving me my meal, and there were my earrings. And, yeah, well, and, you know, and it's not like I didn't confront her in the moment. It was a little bit like, ooh, you know, what do I do? And I talked to my boss. I said, you know, one of the kitchen staff, she stole my earrings. She went into my tent and she stole my earrings, and I'd like them back. And that was sort of the end of the story in my mind. I got them back. I never paid attention to what happened to her. She got, I never paid attention. In fact, I don't think I thought of that experience since I was 19. And it just was a memory that was just like, now what was the squeeze in the heart? What was that feeling of regret that came up? And it was because I had no concern for her. I didn't even see her. I just saw the earrings on her. And there was no examination in my heart of, like, what, you know, why she would steal earrings and just the whole privilege aspect of it. But, you know, there was just so much to the picture that my mind was just really simple. There are my earrings and I want them back. And so it's not like I did anything wrong. I'm not judging the action, but I'm just judging, not judging, that's not right, but just was aware that the qualities of my mind were not that sensitive when I showed up in that moment and in the way that I acted. And so that just like, okay, Wynn, you know, how can I really show up with full sensitivity, with the big, broad picture, with this being as informed as I can when I'm getting groceries at the store or when I'm, you know, whatever it may be, you know, each moment, an adventure in consciousness, where I'm showing up with that kind of enlivened presence, that wakeful presence. And there was a beautiful story I want to read, which is to me an example of showing up. a powerful and appropriate response to a complicated and fearful situation. And this was on NPR. Maybe you heard it, it was a few months ago. It's called A Victim Treats His Mugger Right. So Julio Diaz, and on NPR, he actually tells the story, and it's quite beautiful to hear it in his voice. Julio Diaz has a daily routine. Every night, the 31-year-old social worker ends his hour-long subway commute to the Bronx one stop early, just so he can eat at his favorite diner. But one night last month, as Diaz stepped off the number 6 train and onto a nearly empty platform, his evening took an unexpected turn. He was walking toward the stairs when a teenage boy approached him and pulled out a knife. Diaz says, "He wants my money, so I gave him my wallet and told him, 'Here you go.'" As the teen began to walk away, Diaz told him, "Hey, wait a minute. You forgot something. If you're going to be robbing people for the rest of the night, you might as well take my coat to keep you warm." The would-be robber looked at his would-be victim like, "What's going on here?" Diaz says, "He asked me, 'Why are you doing this?'" And Diaz replied, "If you're willing to risk your freedom for a few dollars, then I guess you must really need the money. I mean, all I wanted to do was get dinner. And if you really want to join me, hey, you're more than welcome." Diaz says, "You know, I felt maybe he just really needed help." So he and the teen went into the diner and sat in a booth. The manager comes by, the dishwashers come by, the waiters come by to say hi, Diaz says. And the kid was like, "You know everybody here. Do you own this place?" "No, I just eat here a lot," Diaz says, he told the teen. And the teen says, "But you're nice even to the dishwasher." And Diaz replied, "Well, haven't you been taught that you should be nice to everybody?" "Yeah, but I didn't think people actually behaved that way," the teen said. Diaz asked him what he wanted out of life. "And he just had almost a sad face," Diaz says. The teen couldn't answer Diaz, or he didn't want to. When the bill arrived, Diaz told the teen, "Look, I guess you're going to have to pay for this, Bill, because you have my money and I can't pay for this. So if you give me my wallet back, I'll gladly treat you." So the teen didn't even think about it and returned the wallet, Diaz says. "I gave him $20. I figure maybe it'll help him. I don't know." And then Diaz says, "I asked him for something in return, his knife, and he gave it to me." Afterward, when Diaz told his mother what had happened, she said, "You're the type of kid that if someone asked you for the time, you gave them your watch." I figure, you know, if you treat people right, you can only hope that they treat you right. It's as simple as it gets in this complicated world. So this was an appropriate response, and a fearless response, and a response that came from a confident heart and clear seeing. And this brings me to another teaching about appropriate response. Those are actually the words. A 10th century Zen master called Uman, who as he was dying, was visited by one of his students. The student asked, "What is the teaching of your entire lifetime?" The teacher replied, "An appropriate response." So this points to me that there aren't rules. You know, it's like the mind needs to be fresh in each moment, right? There's not like rules of conduct. And we need to be discerning in a precise way. And for that, we need to do our homework. We need to have a wide awareness. And we need to have a stable mind. So that's the samadhi, that's the concentration piece, the leg of the stool, of stability. You know, knowing our own forces of greed, of anger, of delusion in the mind. So until we know those forces, we're going to be knocked around by them. And we won't have that stability, we won't have that clarity. And we get better at it. We get better at the stability and the seeing of these powerful afflictive mind states. And Joseph Goldstein gives just a beautiful metaphor when we're first learning concentration or even just learning mindfulness. He says it's like an upside-down bowl with a marble on the top. And then the least sort of affliction, the least force that comes into the mind, that agitates the mind, that marble will roll off. And with practice, that bowl gets inverted, so the bowl is in its normal, and the marble sits at the bottom, and a force will come by, and it might displace the marble, but it rolls right back down to the center. There's a kind of weight, stability to the mind. And so over time, we move from the inverted bowl to the right side bowl, and that marble in the center is less likely to get knocked off. So that's what we want. We don't want to be knocked off by our afflictive mind states. So we can see mindfulness as a kind of protection and a refuge. There's another metaphor that the Buddha uses, and it's like when mindfulness is present, and I think it's important to keep inquiring, like, what do we mean when we say mindfulness? Like, what do we mean? It's not a vague awareness. It's not a dim awareness. It's a purposeful awareness. It has intention. And it's a non-judgmental awareness. It's a non-interfering awareness. So it has a quality of equanimity enough to hold the fury of our anger or of our greed, right? So it's a kind of equanimity that can hold whatever arises in a fearless way. So when we're mindful, when anger arises, it's not the same as just being in anger. Mindfulness of anger is a kind of space that can hold anger. So this is this quality of equanimity that's cultivated through mindfulness. So when mindfulness is present, when an afflictive mind state comes up, it would be like a ball of yarn being thrown at a hard door. It doesn't make an imprint on the mind, right? It just kind of slides off. But when mindfulness is not present, and irritation or anger, whatever it may be, arises, it's like a stone being hurled into clay, and it makes a print, right? And those prints live in us, and they affect how we live in the world. They have a ripple effect, right? So it's about taking care of ourselves and taking care of the world when we get to know the power of these forceful afflictions. So I was thinking about when we have the impulse to hate, whether it's hating ourselves or hating others, and I was noticing, like, just lately with the political situation, like, I really like watching Bill Maher and Stephen Colbert, and I kind of, it's like delicious to me when there's like this little skewer toward Donald Trump, right? You know, and I think there's some of it that is like, feels right because there's a level of truth telling, like there's a level of truth telling, but there's part of it that I recognize, oh yeah, there's ill will kind of also in some of these commentaries, and I this is an active question about like, do I just add to the pile of hate, you know? When am I adding? Just adding to the pile of hate. And I remember Ajahn Sumedho gave a talk in the 80s, and he was saying that in his monastery in England, that every morning they send metta, or kindness, to Margaret Thatcher. So this was, you know, back in the 80s, right? And Margaret Thatcher, who was sort of the leadership of the Conservative Party and a controversial figure, and much hated by many people, and it was their practice to send metta to Margaret Thatcher. And so I was thinking, oh, that's a lesson, man. And sending kindness to Donald Trump in no way is approving of his behavior. Like, that's a different thing, right? It's not condoning anything. It's like this, the quality of heart and discerning what's right and what's not right are different ballparks, and it's important not to confuse them, because we can feel sort of a self-righteous anger, like that there's some power and purpose in that anger, but that's not how it is. I mean, maybe anger is a better force than like being depressed or distanced, for instance. But, you know, as like Thich Nhat Hanh said, compassion is a much more powerful force for change, both toward ourselves and toward the world. And it's sustainable, because we know how anger is crippling. We know that it burns us. So, you know, the Buddha had said this in no uncertain terms, that anger is an affliction. And so I really am really working with that, like, you know, that how to remain active and engaged and in there for the long haul and not burn up, you know, not burn up, that's not useful. And more, I'm not willing to fuel, I'm not willing to cherish that kind of self-righteousness and anger when it comes up. And I see the power of equanimity, I'm valuing that more and more. I want to read a little bit some of Buddha's words about this. So this is from Bhikkhu Anileo. He's a German monk, Excursions into the Thought World. And he has some, I think, really good things to say about ill will or hatred. He says, a simile of the Buddha compares the presence of the hindrance of ill will in the mind to copper as a corruption of gold. Due to such corruption, the gold will be brittle and unfit for use by the goldsmith, as it has lost its malleability and radiance. The image reveals the loss of workability of the mind due to the presence of ill will. A similar idea underlies another image in which a strangling fig encircles a tree, bends it, and eventually splits it apart. Just as such a creeper weakens the tree it overgrows, so too the hindrance of ill will, if it is allowed to overgrow the mind, weakens and eventually destroys wisdom. And then he speaks about how to overcome ill will. And the first thing he says is the first aspect in the instruction given in the Satipatthana Sutta is a clear recognition of the presence of ill will. And I think it's important, this is me, I think it's important that we understand sort of the range of ill will. Like sometimes when we're in full rage, you know, it becomes really unworkable and we just have to, you know, tie ourselves down. Like that's not like a moment for effective mindfulness. But when irritations come up, those small irritations, they are really valuable. It's a really valuable place to work because we're stable enough still that we can investigate, understand the conditions that gave rise to that irritability. So that's just an insert. Clear recognition of the presence of ill will is of considerable importance. Instead of immediately reacting, the task is to allow mindfulness the time and space to clearly recognize that ill will is present in the mind and to see what has caused its arising. It is only when this first step of clearly assessing the situation has been carried to its completion that removal of ill will comes in its proper place. And then he talks about overcoming, you know, that when we know that we've got some anger, that the task is around right effort, namely to arouse energy and to strive to overcome any ill will. So there's sort of different strategies for of dealing with that, but I just want to say one thing, like when things are really out of control and we just want to not cause harm. You know, it's like this is an unworkable mind state, but what do we do so as not to cause harm? The Buddha had a really great teaching, and I'll read this. This is actually from Shantideva's commentary on the Buddha's words. When the mind is haughty, sarcastic, full of conceit and arrogance, ridiculing, evasive, and deceitful, when it is inclined to boast, or when it is contemptuous of others, abusive and irritable, then I should remain still like a piece of wood. Yeah, I mean, it's like sometimes suppression is the best, right? Like, it's like the best we can hope for, just to kind of not act out of this place, which we are going to feel the consequences of later. So this is like the least best of options, like holding something with wisdom and mindfulness and attention and sensitivity. That's a better option if we're in a place to do that. But if we can't do that, be still like a piece of wood. I think it's just brilliant, a piece of wood. But... okay. And here's just one more piece. Though the second step of removing ill will should certainly not be neglected, by doing so too quickly, one would miss an opportunity to develop an experiential wisdom when ill will arises in the mind. Since such wisdom will eventually lead to the total removal of ill will from a long-term perspective, it is of considerable importance that the initial mindful observation of ill will is given full space. So, to not fear, like, if that irritability, that anger is in a manageable place, to not be afraid of it, but to investigate, to lean in, to understand its roots. So that's the deeper teaching with its long-term effects. And then the Buddha goes into, you know, all the physical ramifications that we can notice when we're angry and how important it is to pay attention to that. I've just been working lately just with this area of the solar plexus, I'm just aware of how sensitive it is. And my, hatred, or actually the wider category is aversion, with hatred on one side of the coin and fear on the other side of the coin. They're both considered the category of aversion, sort of different colors of the same thing. So my tendency is more toward fear than anger. And it's just like, instead of getting into the story of the fear, it's like I just anchor the attention right here, and it's a wilderness of activity. It's like a wilderness of, oh my. So, and it interests me. And so it's a real anchor and a stable anchor that I use it, and I learn, really learn from, and I develop compassion for myself. It's like, oh my God, no wonder you're exhausted. Right? No wonder we're exhausted. If we felt all the time what was going on with us physically. And then the last sort of antidote, the Buddha talks about when we're angry, we have a narrow mind, that the perception and the perspective is small. Upandita used to say, tiny mind, in this like dripping contemptuous way. I mean, he's a fierce figure, but like, you know, when you act out of a tiny mind. Bhikkhu Anileo is saying here, true broadening of the mind comes about through the development of loving kindness, metta, whose meditative radiation is quite literally boundless, as well as being free from anger and ill will. So when we are in kindness, we are not in anger or hatred. So that cultivation of metta, which is the practice that we do here, is an antidote to both fear and hatred. Jack Kornfield asked Deepa Ma, whose picture is in the community room, she is a Burmese lay woman and a beautiful teacher. What is it like in your mind? He asked her. Deepa Ma smiled, closed her eyes, and quietly answered, in my mind there are three things, concentration, loving kindness, and peace. And then again, the quote that comes to my mind when I have an impulse to get angry, hatred never ceases by hatred, but only by love. This is an ancient and eternal law. So those are the Buddha's words. Yeah, and I think it's useful for me too, like, you know, when I am aware of my fear, and you know, I used to hate it. I mean, that was my relationship, like hating fear. It's like, I'm sick of it. I'm done with it. And just all this hatred that I think in a sort of unconscious way, I saw it as a weapon. Like this hatred will uproot it, you know, like, because it has so much force. But, you know, in reality, you know, it fuels that battle. It fuels the difficulty. So we know this, right? We know that hatred, you know, it doesn't serve it. So, you know, working with my fear has been all about like allowing, making space. That sort of mindful awareness is like, I learned that as a performer, you know, I just had to really accept fear and really get interested in its qualities and its power. And that's when things began to shift for me. And so when I had that impulse externally, like to hate Donald Trump or hate what's going on in our country, it's like it really is an inquiry. It, you know, if it's true, what's going on with me, you know, the forces in my own mind and heart, is that true? You know, when it's all directed outward, is hatred skillful in this condition? And my gut, and according to the Buddha also, is no, that this doesn't serve a purpose, and it doesn't help us to discern. And in fact, makes our ability to see clearly what's going on compromised. So just before we end and talk together, I wanted to just read one more short story. And this is about how aversion clouds our perception, how it clouds the clarity of our mind. And this is from a book called And There Was Light by Jacques Lusseron. Maybe some of you have heard of him. He was a French author and political activist. And as a 17-year-old, he began he was a part of the French Resistance and occupied France, and he is also a Holocaust survivor. But he was blinded as a seven-year-old, and I was just really struck by his experience that he relates to when he was adjusting to his blindness. So I wanted to talk about that. He writes, it was a great surprise to me to find myself blind, and being blind was not at all as I imagined it. He had had an accident at school. Nor was it as the people around me seemed to think. They told me that to be blind meant not to see. Yet how was I to believe them when I saw? Not at once, I admit. Not in the days immediately after the operation. For at that time, I still wanted to use my eyes. I followed their usual path. I looked in the direction where I was in the habit of seeing before the accident. And there was anguish, a lack, something like a void, which filled me with what grown-ups called despair. Finally, one day, and it was not long in coming, I realized that I was looking in the wrong way. It was as simple as that. I was making something very like the mistake people make who change their glasses without adjusting themselves. I was looking too far off and too much on the surface of things. This was much more than a simple discovery. It was a revelation. I can still see myself in the Champ de Mars where my father and I had taken me for a walk a few days after the accident. Of course, I knew the garden well, its ponds, its railings, its iron chairs. I even knew some of the trees in person. And naturally, I wanted to see them again, but I couldn't. I threw myself forward into the substance which was space, but which I did not recognize because it no longer held anything familiar to me. At this point, some instinct, I was almost about to say a hand laid on me, made me change course. I began to look more closely, not at things, but at a world closer to myself, looking from an inner place to one further within, instead of clinging to the movement of sight toward the outside world. Immediately, the substance of the universe drew together, redefined and peopled itself anew. I was aware of a radiance emanating from a place I knew nothing about, a place which might as well have been outside me as within. But radiance there was, or, to put it more precisely, light. It was a fact, for light was there. I felt indescribable relief and happiness so great it almost made me laugh. Confidence and gratitude came as if a prayer had been answered. I found light and joy at the same moment, and I can say without hesitation that from that time on, light and joy have never been separated in my experience. I have had them or lost them together. The amazing thing was that this was not magic for me at all, but reality. I could no more have denied it than people with eyes can deny that they see. I was not light myself, I knew that, but I bathed in it as an element which blindness had suddenly brought much closer. I could feel light rising, spreading, resting on objects, giving them form, then leaving them. Withdrawing or diminishing is what I mean, for the opposite of light was never present. Sighted people always talk about the night of blindness, and that seems to them quite natural. But there is no such night, for at every waking hour and even in my dreams, I lived in the stream of light. Still, there were times when the light faded, almost to the point of disappearing. It happened every time I was afraid. If, instead of letting myself be carried along by confidence and throwing myself into things, I hesitated, calculated, thought about the wall, the half-open door, the key in the lock, if I said to myself that all these things were hostile and about to strike or scratch, then without exception I hit or wounded myself. The only way to move through the house, the garden, or the beach was by not thinking about it at all, or thinking as little as possible. Then I moved between obstacles the way they say bats do. What the loss of my eyes had not accomplished was brought about by fear. It made me blind. Anger and impatience had the same effect, throwing everything into confusion. The minute before I knew just where everything was in the room, but if I got angry, things got angrier than I. They went and hid themselves in the most unlikely corners, mixed themselves up, turned turtle, muttered like crazy men, and looked wild. As for me, I no longer knew where to put hand or foot. Everything hurt me. This mechanism worked so well that I became cautious. When I was playing with my small companions, if I suddenly grew anxious to win, to be first at all costs, then at once I could see nothing. Literally, I went into fog or smoke. I could no longer afford to be jealous or unfriendly, because as soon as I was, a bandage came down over my eyes, and I was bound hand and foot and cast aside. All at once a black hole opened, and I was helpless inside it. But when I was happy and serene, approached people with confidence and thought well of them, I was rewarded with light. So is it surprising that I loved friendship and harmony when I was very young? Armed with such a tool, why should I need a moral code? For me, this took the place of red and green lights. I always knew where the road was open and where it was closed. I had only to look at the bright signal, which taught me how to live. So that feels a little bit like the bright guardians of the world. So, This was a lot. It's 8:15, so I have a little forgiveness meditation, but maybe first we could just talk together, see what came up for you, what questions you have, or thoughts about harming and non-harming.
So my question is, you talked about how the feeling part can be really different than the seeing part or the understanding part. So you could see something that was really wrong. Sure, you could see something that was really wrong, but yet not experience aversion. And I guess I'm wondering about skillful truth-telling or skillful response to things that we perceive as unacceptable.
When you say skillful response, you mean like skillful action or...
Skillful action. But, I mean, it could be as simple as in a conversation.
Yeah. So I'm not sure your question. Maybe you could say it one more time.
So let's say that someone we care about does something that we see as really harmful. Mm. Or that harms us personally. And, you know, like in your story with the robbery, I mean, he didn't know that kid, right? It might be more difficult with somebody who you're close to. So how do you both have that, hold that loving kindness and respond to the difficulty or the earrings or the, you know?
Yeah, totally. And there's not one answer, but like maybe when we think of our intimate relationships, for instance, where like that's what comes to mind, because this is an ongoing practice. The guiding teacher here, Martin Unberg, is my husband. So we have a lot of journeys around like how we're skillful together. And it's like for a long time in my practice, like whenever I would respond with anger to something that he said, I would be like a piece of wood. Right? But it, you know, that being a piece of wood came to be like a kind of not dealing. Like I saw what I'm being a piece of wood became actually a disengagement. So it's like we have to know what we're doing, you know. So there was it's in the present, you know, there's an appropriate heedfulness where I'm really aware, you know, it's a hot territory if I'm speaking out of anger. And we just need to take care. And we both speak out of anger. You know, we do. That's kind of part. But we try and hold that with a greater wisdom. And I think for me, the important thing is to recognize that, you know, this anger isn't my friend. So sometimes something needs to be said. And it's like, and I'm not able to say it, you know, if I wait till later, sometimes that thing will never be said. And sometimes I do wait till later, but just kind of with my personality, I was noticing, yeah, a lot isn't being said that needs to be said. So now I'm like, you know, speaking more in this place of anger but holding it with this other wisdom that you know, this is not like, I don't want to use this anger as a weapon. This is not good. But this needs to be said. So it's a dance of just figuring it out. And like I said, it's not like one thing. Unfortunately, I have a partner who's kind of on the same page about like, you know, these instances are occasions for practice. And we can make mistakes. I had one teacher that said, make your mistakes as quickly as possible. Yeah, I love it. So we try things and we learn. Hope that was helpful.
I was just thinking of something when you were talking about the political realm and what can arise in us in response to that. I think I told this story once in the meta group probably about 4 or 5 years ago. So some of you may have heard this, but when I was young, Richard Nixon was president, and I was sure there could never be a worse president than Richard Nixon. I guess I was wrong, but 20 years later, around the time that Richard Nixon died, I don't know when that was, in the mid-90s, maybe, I was watching Barbara Walters was interviewing Minister Farrakhan from the Nation of Islam, and suddenly it was like, you know, we interrupt this program with a special, you know, Richard Nixon has died, and they cut away from the program, and for the next, you know, several days, everything was about, you know, the life of Nixon and Watergate and whatever, you know. And there was a segment that apparently this is something that Richard Nixon said in 1974 when he was flying off to California, you know, when he resigned. But I didn't hear it at the time. I heard it, you know, 20 years later, the night that he died. He said, "Those people who hate us don't win unless we hate them." And, you know, it was like the most profound thing I ever heard him say. But it was like this gift, you know, suddenly this man who I had, you know, hated or feared or despised or whatever, you know, suddenly he was this old man going off to his karmic whatever inheritance, and he was just, you know, and he gifted me with this teaching, and it just like totally disarmed all of that. And I don't know if it makes sense what I'm trying to say, but it's like when we open ourselves to these kind of situations, you know, we can receive really profound teachings from anywhere. And for me, that was it. You know, I don't hate the guy anymore. He's just like, so he didn't win.
My name is Tim. I just wanted to mention something I read in the Goldstein book on mindfulness. He mentioned it was about the poisons of the mind, greed, anger, and delusion, and how we tend to look at them as things we need to get rid of. But I, in this passage from his book, he made it seem like there's just functions of the mind that we haven't learned how to use yet. We haven't learned how to use them in a skillful way. And he said, specifically with regards to aversion, it can, if you learn how to use it, it's like qualities like judgment, discrimination. These are things that our minds are always doing, but we just haven't learned how to use them in the right way, or a way that is helpful. And if you learn how to use them, they turn into what he called discriminating wisdom, which is knowing, it brought to mind knowing what is right and wrong. You can know what is right and wrong spontaneously. And it also goes a long way towards concentration, which is, it's a kind of impersonal experience at the same time of I don't know. That's all I got.
Yeah. Well, I think what you say makes me think of is that, you know, there's this aspect of mindfulness that is non-controlling, right? That we allow mind states to arise in the way that weather moves. So we don't need to be afraid of our fear, or we don't need to be afraid of our anger, and that they are places to investigate. When they become dangerous is when we become slave to them, and they determine our actions. You know, they are the force the unconscious force that gets us into patterns and that causes harm. But as a mind state, you know, we can allow them to do their full dance. And as long as we're in a place that the curiosity and tension is there, and it's not a blind reactivity. So that's the problem, is when we are blindly reactive, where most of us are most of the time. So yeah, so that's just the key. And then and in terms of aversion, you know, the Buddha really makes a point that aversion and discrimination are not the same, right? It's like that clear, sharp, discerning awareness is actually, we're more capable of that when these qualities of aversion are not in the mind. Greed is not in the mind, aversion is not in the mind, or at least we're not being whipped around by it. Then that precision of awareness discernment is more clear. Probably room for maybe one more thought.
That just reminded me of something also by Joseph Goldstein. There is a talk that I saw that is on YouTube. He gave in Geneva a few years ago. And he tells a story that when he started giving his Dharma talks when he was a student, and his teacher told him, okay, on Wednesdays or something, you give the talk. He would find himself to start counting how many people showed up. But the interesting thing was that it was something that happened in his mind, and he didn't, I don't know how to say, he didn't own it, right? He said, it was almost funny to him that his mind was doing this. Yeah. And there were all these games that the minds are playing, and he, I mean, it's very easy to fall into the trap of say, why am I doing this? What am I doing? Why am I counting?
Yeah.
And he took it very, I don't know, lightly, and those are games that our mind plays.
Yeah, I think that's just a beautiful piece of wisdom to not identify, you know, like when those powerful forces of fear, it's like, it's just fear. It's just fear. You know, it's not like me. It doesn't define who I am or whatever. Yeah, and just like the mind is doing this now, the mind is doing that now, and we don't need to identify with it. We can hold it really lightly. Yeah, thank you so much. It's a great ending thought. So let's just sit for a moment. Just let go of the words.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.